What's good?
Welcome back to Co-Signed. If you're new here, I'm Mackenzie.
And I'm Sam. We're your hosts of this very real, raw, and hilarious podcast.
You're gonna love it.
So go ahead.
Grab your snacks, your coffee, your wine.
Whatever your vice is.
And let's get into it. Oh my god.
Oh my god. I'm loving it.
We're back. All right, guys. Just like last week, we are going to go over and start the episode with a few must-see Netflix shows and or documentaries.
These are some goodies.
Yes. And again, some of these are dramatizations, several are documentaries, and others are docuseries, but all are based on true events.
Just before we start going over those, we want to go ahead and give you guys the trigger warning. So several of these shows and documentaries discuss highly sensitive topics, including murder, sexual assault, animal abuse, violence, and more. Some were distressing for us to watch, so viewer discretion is advised.
Absolutely. First one we're going to recommend for you to watch, American Murder, The Family Next Door.
Which we've
seen.
We've talked about a little bit in a previous episode as well.
Insane.
And, you know, we don't want to say too much to give it away, but
there's really not much you can say without giving it away in that one. Right. So just watch it. Trust us. Number two is The Keepers, which I personally have not seen, but Sam has.
Yes. Once again, it is a very disturbing documentary. It's covered around, like, nuns and the Catholic Church and things that were going on in this area. This woman disappeared and was found killed, and it goes into basically what was happening to them at this school they were at, and it kind of snowballs from there. They end up finding out a lot of other things going on, so
I can imagine.
It's a very good documentary, but it's a little upsetting.
Yeah. As most of these are. Number three, we both have seen. It is The Disappearance of Madeline McCann.
Lots of theories around her.
A lot of theories around this one. It's definitely one, at least from in my opinion, that you have to pay attention to.
Yeah.
Like, you have to watch it. It's not something you can just, like, turn on and just, like, do other things while you're watching it. Like, I would definitely recommend to pay attention in this one.
I did watch a follow-up documentary later. They're pretty sure that they know who took her and what happened to her. It's still
sad.
Like she said, the details are very important. There's a lot of small things that you could miss.
Absolutely.
If you're not paying attention. But it is a very good documentary.
Yes. Number four, The Kalief Browder Story. Which, again, I feel like I haven't seen this, but Sam has. And you definitely recommend. It's hard to watch, right?
It's very hard to watch. I'm convinced, just like we said about Steve Avery, I'm convinced that Kalief Browder was falsely accused, which they pretty much prove that he was, and it was over something as small as a backpack that was stolen, and he ended up spending years and years and years of his life, and they kept him strictly in solitary confinement, and it's one of the more tragic documentaries, but it's a real life story, so it's good to know about those things that are going on.
Yeah. And then last but not least, number five, I Am a Killer. This is probably the strangest one. It's actually a docuseries that actual, like, real life serial killers that are in prison at this very moment are interviewed, and they're asked about their cases, or they openly talk. Some of them don't talk as much. Some of them will just tell you everything, and some of them show no remorse. Some of them are apologetic, but it's just interesting, at least for us, I feel like, because you're hearing it from this person's mouth, and just to see how they behave.
Right.
And see how their mind works, I guess, if that's probably a weird thing.
No, some of them are so creepy, though.
Very creepy.
Be prepared.
Alright guys, just as last week, we are gonna talk about two different cases, and this week, both of ours are unsolved, but I'm gonna jump in with mine. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Are you ready? This week, we mentioned it last episode, but I'm going to talk about the Cleveland Torso Killer, aka the Mad Butcher of Kingsbury Run.
Which I'm excited about this, because I don't know that much about this case.
I didn't either, and I dove in. So before we jump into the story, I am going to give another warning. This story is for mature audiences. It contains graphic descriptions of crime scenes and adult dialogue. Listener discretion is advised. All right, so during the 1930s, Cleveland, Ohio was a city on the rise. Its population was growing, and it essentially was a melting pot of sorts of laborers needed to support the steel and manufacturing base. During this time, one of the most prolific and gruesome serial killers carried out acts of horror, which led to one of the biggest unsolved crimes in American history. Picture this. It's 8 a.m. on the morning of September 5th, 1934. Frank Lagasse was making his way along the shore of Lake Erie. He was looking for wood that he could burn, and in the midst of his hunt, he spotted something off in the distance, which piqued his interest. Obviously, he went to investigate, as you do, and he initially presumed that it was a tree trunk, but as he got closer, he realized it was in fact not a tree trunk. Oh my God. Instead, he made a very gruesome discovery. In front of him were the remains of a female body. The remains consisted of legs from above the knees of the torso. No other body parts were visible. The coroner thought the victim may have been dead for about 6 months, and he thought at least 3 of those months she had spent in the water. He also believed the body may have been in some sort of container, initially due to the lack of water logging in the flesh. The torso was also covered in some sort of preservative chemical, which left her skin a red in color with a very tough texture, almost like leather. Ugh. Results revealed either chloride of lime or calcium hypochlorite. I think I'm saying that right. Now, clearly whoever did this used the wrong type of lime, mm-hmm. because they unknowingly preserved her body instead of
making a decomp.
Now, authorities searched the area and were able to locate a few other body parts, but her head was never found. They believed that she was around her mid-30s, but they were never able to ID her because they had, like, no fingerprints or no dental records to go off of. So, sadly, she has only ever been referred to the Lady of the Lake.
So, basically, he only disposed of the parts that could not identify her.
Basically, of this specific victim. 2 weeks prior to the discovery of the Lady of the Lake, a man named Joseph had discovered some remains on the lake shore. After reporting his discovery, police initially wrote them off as animal bones. Joseph was asked to bury his findings in the sand. Mm-hmm. After reading the discovery of the Lady of the Lake, Joseph decided to contact investigators again. This time, the remains were recovered and taken in for examination. The body parts were found to be human ribs and vertebrae, and the coroner declared that they were an exact match of the Lady of the Lake. But unfortunately, they had no other leads and no other evidence, so this case went cold.
Who tells somebody to, just bury it?
Just keep it moving.
Wow.
Yeah. So about a year later, in 1935, in an area called Kingsbury Run along the east side of Cleveland, Kingsbury Run had once contained a sort of a natural like watershed that drained storm water into the river. But in the 1930s, the area was considered like a rough part of town. During the Great Depression, a lot of like families in that area lost like everything, including their houses. So Kingsbury Run was mainly filled with like debris and trash and like shacks of these people who had nothing, essentially a homeless area. Now, two boys ages 12 and 16 were playing with a ball in Kingsbury Run on a hill called Jackass Hill. While playing with this ball, it went down this hill. The two boys decided to have a race to go and get it. But the 16-year-old boy obviously raced ahead, leaving the 12-year-old boy behind. And I'm sure he's probably wishing he did not win that race, because at the bottom of the hill, instead of finding his ball, he found a human body without its head. There was another set of brothers playing at the top of Jackass Hill, and they spotted another body without its head. When reported to the police, it was thought that the two bodies were initially being reported. Like, they thought it was one report about the same finding. Gotcha. When they got to the scene, they quickly found out that it was, in fact, two bodies without their heads. So, the first victim was a white male, naked except for his socks. His head and his wee were removed. So, he was emasculated. There was a complete lack of blood around the scene or on the body. Does that sound familiar?
Mm-hmm.
The second victim appeared to have died earlier than the first. It was obvious because his body was suffering from a higher amount of decomposition. They believe that he was shorter and stockier than the first victim, and he also appeared to be older. His body also showed signs that some sort of chemical had been applied to it, leaving his skin a reddish color and a leather-like texture. Like the first victim, his head and his penis had been removed, and there was a lack of blood found anywhere on or near the body.
So the first victim's head was found 20 feet away from him, buried, and the second victim's head was found 70 feet away from him, not buried.
When the coroner did the autopsy, victim one had already been identified. His name was Edward, and he was 29. It was noted that Edward had been dead for about 2 to 3 days, and his head had been severed by a knife with a great amount of strength and force and with precision. The second victim remained unidentified. Unfortunately, the amount of decomposition on the body made it impossible to recover any usable fingerprints, but they were able to estimate that this man was between 40 and 45 years old. Like, this coroner was a different one than the Lady of the Lake, and he stated that he believed the substance found on the second corpse was some sort of acid instead of lime. Despite leaving a similar reddish tone and leathery appearance, no link was made between the Lady of the Lake and these two male victims. Attempts to follow a few leads went cold, and police had nothing to go off of, and the discoveries of these two men started to fade until about 4 months later. One morning in January 1936, a woman was walking into a meat market and told the butcher that she had seen two hams wrapped in newspaper and in baskets behind a nearby manufacturing building. Assuming they had been stolen, the butcher went to retrieve them, and he soon discovered the baskets contained human body parts. Investigators found the parts belonging to a woman, lower torso, right arm, right hand, and two thighs to be exact. Police searched the area but found no other traces of the rest of the body. Fingerprints taken from the hand at the scene revealed the victim was a woman named Florence, Flo as she was commonly known. She was about her early 30s, she was a waitress and a part-time prostitute, and was well known to the police in that area. The coroner noted that her right shoulder had been removed at the shoulder blade. The thighs had been separated at the hip and the torso severed at the second lumbar vertebrae. All were made with clean, precise cuts. It was also noted that whoever did this waited until rigor mortis had set in to Flo compared to the other bodies that were done when the body was alive or just at time of death. On February 7th, a man discovered all the remaining parts of Flo's body scattered around the yard of a trucking company, with one exception. Her head was never found. Now, Florence did associate herself in some dubious circles, and the police had no shortage of people to speak to, but once again, none of the leads went anywhere, and it was left unsolved.
What is the deal with the heads?
Where are the heads?
Right.
Mm-hmm. On June 5th, two young boys, ages 13 and 11, had decided to skip school to go fishing in Kingsbury Run. Relatable.
Mistake.
On their way to fish, they came across a bundle wrapped in a pair of trousers. Now, the two boys are probably thinking they found some money or something, you know, left over in these pants. So they started taking their fishing rods and poking and prodding and trying to lift up the pants. The head of a male rolled out of the pants. In order to try and gain an ID, the head was placed on display at the morgue. A face mask was made in the event that the man remained unidentified and needed burying. Actually, in fact, a lot of these victims, they made face masks for.
Yeah.
It's disturbing. But despite over 1,000 people seeing this head over the next 24 hours, no positive ID was given. Now, the next day, police find a tattooed body of a man without its head that seemed to be in his 20s dumped in front of the police department. Again, the body was completely clean, drained of all blood, but this time the body itself was intact. He was not emasculated. Everything was intact except his head. The coroner determined that the time of death had been around 48 hours before the head was found. Police were extremely confident in finding out who this man was because he had fingerprints and highly identifiable tattoos. They put the details of his tattoos out there like, hey, you know, if you know who these tattoos belong to,
right,
let me know. But sadly, despite their best efforts, they were unable to get an ID, and he would only ever be known as the tattooed man. By this point, police had linked the tattooed man to the two men found on Jackass Hill. So in July 1936, a teenager was hiking in the woods when she discovered a naked body in a gully in the Big Creek area, west of Cleveland. This would be the only victim found on the west side. First of all, I just got to say this. Why are all these kids just walking on these trails and in these woods by themselves?
I was going to say, I bet you those two kids never skip school again.
Right. I'm going to school. Anyway.
How traumatic. God.
But just like the previous victims, the head had been severed of this body. Detectives located the missing head about 6 yards from the body along with the victim's clothing. With the other victims, it seemed that they were dropped in random locations after being killed. But it appeared that this victim had been killed where his body was discovered because there was blood and stuff. So maybe he saw something he wasn't supposed to see.
Yeah.
And whoever's doing this is like, well, shit, now I gotta kill you now.
Yeah.
Because you don't just, like, drain all the other bodies and then not drain this one.
Right.
Okay. So pathologists determined that this victim was around 40 years old and due to the incredible amount of decomposition had been dead for approximately 2 months.
Wow.
Meaning that this victim was actually killed before the tattooed man. They were actually unable to definitely prove that the man was a murder victim because he was so decomposed. And like the tattooed man, his we had not been removed. Now, with no fingerprints to go on, police were once again left with little to no options other than just going through missing person files and trying to identify their newest victim, but they had no luck. September 1936, a 25-year-old homeless man discovered two parts of a headless, legless, and armless human torso in a creek on Kingsbury Run. Upon the search of the creek, the lower half of both legs were dredged from the water and bloody clothing was found around the seam. All of this was done in front of a crowd of over 100 onlookers. The victim determined to be about 25 to 30 years old. The head had been severed from the body with clean but very powerful cuts by a very strong blade. Coroners noted that all the cuts were made without hesitation and with complete accuracy, which made them believe that the killer was an expert in human anatomy.
Mm-hmm.
This victim's genitals had been removed, like victims 2 and 3, but during the autopsy, it revealed that the victim was still alive when this body was starting to be dismembered.
Oh my God.
With no arms and no head, detectives knew that the ID would be nearly probably impossible. These waters were basically sewers, but for the next few months, they searched them high and low. They discovered the man's thigh, but unfortunately they were unable to find the head, the arms, anything else. So he is only ever referred to as victim number 6. It was now clear that they had a serial murder on their hands. Now.
You think.
Now. So
you think?
After the first 3 findings, you're like, huh. You had to wait till you had 6 victims. Okay. So the media was covering these killings almost daily, and they're the ones who actually started calling this person the Mad Butcher. And due to the mounting pressure that these murders put on the mayor of Cleveland, he appointed Elliot Ness in charge of the investigation. He was known for, like, taking down Al Capone.
Oh, okay.
So he was real, back in that day, I mean, he was known by criminals. But he creates this group of experts, himself, detectives, coroners, and they come up with a profile of who they think that they're looking for. The killer would be more patient before taking his next victim, however. About 6 months passes since the discovery of victim number 5, and in February 1937, a man was making his way across the shore of Lake Erie looking for wood. These people are just constantly looking for wood, I guess. And he spotted something that he assumed was a sheep, but it was not. He stumbled upon the headless and armless upper torso of a woman's body. There were no signs that the body had been, you know, deliberately left at that point. It was suspected that it was merely the location of which it had just washed up on shore. Now, it's one hell of a coincidence that the body washed up in the same spot as the Lady of the Lake. But it wasn't a coincidence to the media. And for the first time, there was actual talk of the Lady of the Lake being a victim of the Mad Butcher. This new victim was determined to be 25 to 30 years old, and she seemed to have been dead for about 3 days. There were 2 points made by coroners that would put question marks against whether the latest victim was killed at the hands of this serial killer. First point, they noticed that hesitation marks in the cuts, unlike previous murders. Secondly, they confirmed that the cause of death was not due to decapitation because they could tell that her heart had already stopped beating before. And because of these 2 points, it was decided by the majority that she not be included among the killer's victims. 3 months after her initial discovery, the lower half of her torso was found. The cold waters of Lake Erie had actually kept her torso in good condition, and they were able to match it to her what they had in the morgue. But the rest of the body was never found, including the head. Now, we're in June 1937. Another teenager, a 14-year-old, was on his way home, and sticking out from a pile of garbage, he spotted a human skull. Upon arrival, the police found the skeletal remains of a human, but the arms and legs were absent. From said skeletal remains, a professor of anatomy, Dr. T.W. Todd, was unable to state the exact cause of death, but he was able to determine that there were knife marks and signs of cutting at the points of sever, and it was also noted that these were in the same areas as the previous victims had been decapitated. Another pathologist declared that the victim to be a 40-year-old African-American female. Her name was Rose Wallace. So one of the detectives found a possible link between Rose Wallace and the earlier victim, Flo, because they were both part-time prostitutes in the area. But despite connections made, they were unable to have anything concrete. So again, with no other leads, these cases went cold. There's just no leads at this point. Okay, so now we're back to July 1937. Police were called with reports of a discovery of a torso floating in the river along Kingsbury Run. The Coast Guard was now summoned to help recover the torso, and this time it was the lower half of a male torso, and the Coast Guard retrieved thighs, both arms and lower legs, in a burlap sack wrapped in newspaper, but the head was never found. They could never identify him. In a slight change, the abdominal cavity of this victim had been sliced open. He or she had removed everything inside. For a minute, things were quiet. For almost a year, no sightings or discoveries of any other bodies were reported, and police were thinking, okay, maybe it's finally over, you know, but of course not. Can't do that to you.
People don't just stop.
So April 1938, a man was on his way to work and thought he had seen a dead fish.
Nope.
Just the remains of a lower leg.
Oh my God.
Police searched the waters for further remains, and about a month later, in May, they discover a burlap sack containing the headless torso cut in two, a left foot and the remaining part of the thigh. This time, the coroner was able to establish that the latest victim of the Cleveland torso murderer was 30 years old and she was female. Coroners also noted that the killer showed signs that the cuts were becoming more erratic and less measured than the earlier stages of this murder spree. Also seemed that for the very first time in these crimes, the killer had used drugs on his or her victim. The victim's lungs revealed a large enough dose of morphine that would have resulted in them becoming unconscious, and in fact, the dose was so large that it would have caused death on its own. This murder would follow a familiar trend. The missing head was never found, nor the victim's identity. Now, August 1938. A victim's torso was wrapped in a man's blue blazer and then wrapped again in an old quilt. The legs and arms were discovered in a makeshift box wrapped in butcher paper. This victim was also decapitated, but they discovered the head close to the body. And for the second time only, the killer had left the entire body to be found. It was also noted that some of the body parts had been refrigerated. But while searching for more evidence, the remains of yet another body
was discovered.
Just a lot of bodies going on in Cleveland. But sadly, these two bodies were never identified. Pathologists said that the first victim found that day was a white female around 35, and the bones of the second victim found that day were put back together, and it was determined to be male, and he had been dead for at least 7 months. So, you remember Elliot Ness, I just mentioned him, the one that the mayor put in charge of the investigation. And I just said that he was most famous for taking down Al Capone. Again, he was pretty famous among criminals. And it seemed that the killer was taunting Elliot because these two bodies were found basically in front of his office. He got really angry. So, with him being the safety director over Cleveland and the lead investigator, this put him in charge of all the fire departments and all the police departments. So, he ordered a group of maybe 30 to 40 police and firemen to go set that area, I told you the homeless people were living in, on fire. This was a place where homeless and less fortunate people lived, and Elliot believed that the killer was living within these shacks, so he burned it all to the ground. Now, the media and the community did not, like, this did not sit well with them at all. They did not think that the killer was in there, that you might have just burnt down evidence. You never know. Like, that's not gonna solve the murders.
How is that even a thing?
Literally lit it all on fire.
Wow.
And surprisingly, the killing stopped after this. They had three suspects, two of which were doctors, but nothing really concrete enough to hold these men, so they had to let them all go. The media eventually dubs the Mad Butcher the Cleveland Torso Killer, and the case ends with a letter addressed to the chief of police on December 21st, 1941.
Oh, so this was a few years later.
And the letter's typed out. It wasn't written. It wasn't like letters pasted together. And the letter reads, quote, "Chief of Police, you can rest easy now as I have come out to sunny California for the winter. I felt bad operating on those people, but science must advance. Just laboratory guinea pigs found on any public street, and no one missed them when I failed. Right now I have a volunteer who will absolutely prove my theory. They called me mad and a butcher, but the truth will out. I have failed, but once here, the body has not been found and never will be. But the head, minus features, is buried in a gully on Century Boulevard. I feel it is my duty to dispose of the bodies I do. It is God's will not to let them suffer." End quote.
You know, before you read that, I was actually going to say a lot of the victims, the ones that were ID'd were all from out of town, which would make sense for Elizabeth.
Right. Now, this is the very last time that they heard of this killer, from this killer, but 8 years after this letter is when Elizabeth Short is found in sunny California with the same markings and dismemberment as the other victims, and this is why a lot of people believe that the two were linked.
Yeah.
Which makes sense.
Yeah, it does.
These murders remain one big mystery, and nothing has ever been solved. And Elliot even said that for years after the killing stopped, he would still get letters and pictures sent to him by the killer, but they led nowhere. This one was really disturbing. I just feel like once you start, like, cutting people up, it's, I don't know.
And I guess just thinking about it, a lot of people who, like, dismember people do it when they're alive.
Mm-hmm.
As like a torture thing, but he's doing most of them while they're dead. Like, he's just experimenting.
Like, basically, so some of them were alive, some of them were dead, some of them were right when they died. Female, male, all ages.
Yeah.
All ages. So for him, this letter to say, you know, I'm just experimenting. They're basically lab rats. Science must prevail. Like,
which would make sense why it was all over the place.
Right. And if you guys remember last episode, George, who was a main suspect in the Black Dahlia case, was a doctor.
I was gonna say it's George, but they said he disappeared, but he could have just changed his appearance.
That, and people do that. Remember, I also said that he was in and out of the country.
Yeah.
Who's to say that he wasn't going to other states?
Right.
And then back to out of the country.
Yeah.
But if you guys do look up this case online, all of the victims, they made face masks for all the unidentified people. And it's weird that we don't do that nowadays.
Yeah.
But people don't just, like, a head. It's just a head and glass. It's just strange. But we were talking, and there's an episode on Criminal Minds that basically is...
It's actually like a little mini-series
in the show. It's from, which we're assuming it's stemming from this actual case, but it's called The Mad Butcher of Bakersfield. So check that one out, too. Now, that one is scripted. It's not... It's based on the real case, I believe so.
Yeah, and they changed the details a little bit, but,
yeah. You
know, they have to do that for the show.
But that's the case of the Cleveland Torso Killer.
Very disturbing.
Very disturbing.
It's just like we talk about.
Eerie on Lake Erie.
But at the same time, this is in the 30s and 40s.
And what I was thinking, like, I want to know how they were actually, like, the cases that they were actually solving. How were you solving them? Because it seems like you really wouldn't have much to go on.
Yeah.
So people who are killing people in this time frame, like, you're really just getting away with it.
Yeah.
That's the most disturbing part.
Because most of the ones that we've looked at have been between, like, the 30s and 70s.
Right. Like, right after the Great Depression, like, right up until, like, the 50s.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very disturbing.
I think it's harder now because of technology.
Right, and just people just nosy.
Yeah.
I'm just going to film you doing whatever you're doing.
That's so real.
What are you doing? I'm putting you on Snapchat. Snapchat.
That's right. No one had phones back then.
Right.
This week, I am actually going to go over the Zodiac Killer. So I was stuck between a couple I was trying to decide, but after researching, I thought this one was pretty interesting. Just to start, if you've lived under a rock and you don't know who the Zodiac Killer is, in the late 1960s and early 1970s, he murdered at least 5 people, although he claimed to have murdered 37, which I will touch on a little later. If you're interested in learning a little more other than, like, obviously researching on Google or whatever, the top 3 movies that have been linked to the Zodiac: Clint Eastwood's classic, Dirty Harry, which came out in 1971. And then there is David Fisher's critically acclaimed Zodiac movie, which premiered in 2007, which had, like, Jake Gyllenhaal. And then the History Channel also featured a 2017 nonfiction TV series. It was called The Hunt for the Zodiac Killer, which was about investigators hunting to decipher the codes. So to start, I'm going to talk about the 5 known victims of his. So the Zodiac shot and killed David Faraday and Betty Jensen. They were 16 years old on December 20th, 1968. The high school students had been parked on the side of the road in Vallejo, California. Police had no idea why the pair was killed or who had killed them. Just over 6 months later, on July 5, 1969, Darlene, who was 22, and Mike, who was 19, were similarly parked near Blue Rock Springs Park, not far from the previous killings. A man shined a flashlight into their car and shot at the couple. Darlene was killed, but Mike, though seriously injured, was able to give a description of the shooter to the police. Shortly following the shootings, a man called the Vallejo police, claiming credit for them, as well as David and Betty's killings in December. On September 27, 1969, Brian Hartnell and Cecilia Shepherd, 20 and 22, were picnicking near a lake in Napa, California, when they were approached by a man wearing an executioner's mask with a circle cross symbol on it. He tied them up and stabbed them multiple times, leaving a message for the police written on a car door. Cecilia died of her injuries in the hospital while Brian survived. So at this point, with the 3 couples, the guys have lived.
Right.
On October 11th, 1969, cab driver Paul Stein was shot in the head by a passenger. A number of teenagers witnessed the attack and alerted police, giving a description similar to the one they already had for the Zodiac Killer. The sketch of the Zodiac can be found on Google. It's everywhere. Basically a white man with glasses. So when the police went to the crime scene to look for the killer, there was a mix-up in which the police dispatcher told them to be looking for an African-American suspect. Two officers then encountered and let a white man pass resembling the Zodiac's description. Later, the Zodiac would mention the mistake in a letter he wrote to police, suggesting that the officers had in fact been in contact with him only to let him slip away.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Lucky.
Of course.
Right.
Of course there was a mix-up.
So, in the decades since the Stein murder, the cab driver, a number of other killings have been linked to the Zodiac, though none were ever confirmed. Those are the 5 known victims. I'm going to go into the letters. So, he was like the torso killer. He was writing letters to the police all the time. So, starting in 1969, following the attack on Darlene and Mike, the killer began sending letters to the Bay Area newspapers, taking credit for the killings and threatening further violence. In a 1969 letter to the San Francisco Examiner, the killer identified himself as Zodiac for the first time. These letters also often contained cryptograms and ciphers, along with messages that these codes would reveal the killer's identity to anyone who managed to decipher them. The letters were also accompanied by the Zodiac signature, which is the now famous symbol featuring a circle with a cross running through it. While Bay Area police departments and the FBI worked to track down the killer, another letter arrived at the San Francisco Examiner. It began, "Dear Editor, this is the Zodiac speaking." It also described the murders in detail and taunted police for not having been able to crack his code or catch him. Several days later, a high school teacher and his wife were able to solve the cipher, which read, "I like killing people because it is so much fun. It is more fun than killing wild game in the forest because man is the most dangerous animal of all."
How is a high school teacher and his wife gonna solve it in the police camp?
Right. So, 3 days after the fourth known Zodiac killing, Paul Stein, the San Francisco Chronicle received a letter claiming that crime. It was written in the same print as Zodiac's previous letters, and it gave the detail of Paul's murder and was accompanied by a bloody scrap of Paul's shirt. Mm. At the end of the letter, Zodiac mused that he would shoot out the tire of a school bus and, quote-unquote, pick off the kiddies as they came bouncing out.
Oh my gosh.
Although there are only 5 confirmed Zodiac victims, there is reason to believe there have been as many as 37. Because in one letter, the killer included in the note, me equals 37, San Francisco Police Department equals 0.
He's like keeping score.
Yeah. Ugh. Basically. Yeah, 6. So there were 3 suspects that they had at the top of the list. No one has ever been positively identified, obviously, as the Zodiac killer, but 3 suspects tend to dominate theories about the murders. The first, Earl Van Best Jr. So a man named Gary Stewart wrote a book arguing that the Zodiac killer is in fact his father, which was this guy.
Uh-huh.
And he bears a striking resemblance to the police sketch developed after Paul Stein's murder. The number of the letters in his name coincides with one of the Zodiac ciphers.
Mm. Interesting.
Yeah. The second one is Lawrence K. Lawrence K. lived near where the victims lived or died. And the sister of one of his victims claimed that he had been bothering her sister in the weeks before she was murdered. One of the cops who encountered the man who may have been the Zodiac following Paul Stein's murder also said that Kane bore the best resemblance to the man he had seen on the street shortly after the killing. The third one is the best one of all.
Mm-hmm.
I'm convinced this is the guy, and when I read this to you, you're going to be like, what the F?
Okay.
This guy's name is Arthur Allen. So a political cartoonist named Robert Graysmith, who worked at the San Francisco Chronicle when the murders began in the late 60s, alleged that the Zodiac was Arthur Lee Allen. There are a number of factors that place Allen under suspicion. For example, on the day of the Zodiac's third attack, Allen had said he was going scuba diving in the same lake. He came back covered in blood and bearing a knife. Remember, the Zodiac stabbed his victims. A friend of Allen said that he'd heard Allen refer to himself as Zodiac, and when police searched Allen's trailer, they found bloody knives, sexual objects, and dissected animals. In a later search, they found homemade bombs as well. Allen was jailed for child molestation starting in 1974, which just so happened to be when the Zodiac letters suddenly stopped.
That's him.
Yeah.
It's gotta be.
I was like, who? Casually, he just came home covered in blood with a knife.
Zodiac.
Just the craziest thing. So, a cool fact that I had looked up. So, there are 3 letters and codes that he sent that were never able to be deciphered by anyone who had tried. So, in December of 2020, so this past December.
It would happen in 2020.
Right? One of these 3 was finally decoded. So in December 2020, a team of volunteer code breakers announced that they had cracked the 340-character cipher the Zodiac sent to the San Francisco Chronicle in 1969. The first cipher Zodiac sent to newspapers was quickly solved, but the 340 cipher eluded the efforts of the world's best mathematicians, detectives, and cryptologists for the last 51 years, not to mention even the NSA, the CIA, and the FBI could not crack this code.
Wow.
After working on the code for 15 years, cryptologist David, I can't say his last name, responded to a comment on one of his videos about the cipher. It sparked a collaboration between himself and a mathematician named Sam Blake. Not long afterward, a third man joined the pair. All 3 worked remotely to find a solution, but it was Van Eyck, who was the third to join, who wrote the software that actually solved the puzzle. According to an interview Blake gave, the 3 decrypted the message by running about 650,000 possible solutions through the supercomputers at the University of Melbourne. They asked him in an interview, and he said, there's been a lot of solutions in the past that have required artistic creativity and a lot of bending and massaging of the cipher in order to get it to make a few eligible words. then something like a sentence, and often then the name of somebody who could be associated with the case. What we did was a very different approach to that. We looked at different possible ways you could read the cipher, what other reading directions they could have taken in terms of trying to write it out, and we then ran them through supercomputers and looked for a solution in that direction. So,
they cracked.
51 years later, here is what that code said. I hope you are having lots of fun in trying to catch me. That wasn't me on the TV show, which brings up a point about me. I am not afraid of the gas chamber because it will send me to paradise all the sooner. Because I now have enough slaves to work for me where everyone else has nothing when they reach paradise. They are afraid of death. I am not afraid because I know that my new life will be an easy one in paradise. The FBI has confirmed that the group did indeed decrypt the message, so two of Zodiac's ciphers still remain unsolved.
Right.
Which makes me so curious to know
what they say.
So though true crime fans had hoped the cipher would contain enough information to identify the killer, it hasn't happened yet. So for the time being, the Zodiac's identity remains a mystery. I did a few fun sidebar facts. That I didn't know, most people won't know. It was actually the killer, not law enforcement or the press, who created the name Zodiac, which is usually the media's naming them. Not only did Zodiac demand his letters be published to avoid future deaths, but he also expressed his anger that Zodiac buttons had not been printed for people to wear around town. At the time, buttons were popular and Californians could often be seen wearing peace buttons or black power buttons. All of the male victims in the three couple murders survived. Oddly enough, David Faraday, believed to be Zodiac's first male victim, also survived until the crime was discovered, and then he later died. Like, he was alive when they got there.
Oh, okay, and then he later died.
Yeah, so all three of the couple murders, the women were dead on arrival, and the men survived. That's not an accident.
No, that was on purpose, for sure.
So, kind of weird. And then the last little sidebar fact. So they think that he may have had an interest in the Middle Ages. Zodiac wore what has been described as an executioner's costume for at least one of his killings. Hartnell told detectives Zodiac appeared wearing clip-on dark glasses, a black executioner's hood with a white circle and cross on the chest, a foot-long knife with a taped wooden handle, and a scabbard with brass rivets, which if you don't know what that is, it's a huge sword or a dagger. Hartnell said the costume looked handmade and was neatly stitched. When Zodiac attacked Hartnell and his girlfriend, he used the knife as his weapon, despite the fact that it would have been easier to just shoot them.
Right.
There is actually some medieval art that features executioners dressed in a similar fashion, usually in all black and occasionally with a cross on their tunics. The most relatable image from the Middle Ages is the one that depicts the death of German serial killer Peter Nears, who was infamous for using black magic to achieve supernatural powers.
So I wonder if he believed, oh, I'm an executioner of these people, so then when I get to paradise, I'll be like good. I'm doing this for the greater good.
Yeah. Very interesting case. But it's weird that he claimed he killed 37 people, but they only wrote letters about
five.
Well, technically,
why would he lie about 37 people?
Technically, he shot 7 people.
Yeah, 5 died.
5 of them died.
Lived. Two of those men lived. Have they like said anything? Do we know? Like, do they even remember anything? Is it known?
I know a lot. He attacked some people at night.
Mm-hmm.
And some people during the day, and they always said he would wear a mask or anything like that, so he wasn't.
So how do they know who they're looking for? Because, you know, they said that they saw him on the street looking like a white man with glasses, so he wore a mask.
I want to say they got that sketch. I don't think he was wearing anything when he killed the cab driver, because they said that teenagers saw him kill the cab driver.
Wow.
And they got the sketch, because when they were looking for him, how lucky can someone get?
These bad people, these people doing these horrible things, and they just go completely unsolved and not in custody. And if it is the person that went to jail for another crime, don't you think that if they had any sort of inkling that it was that man with the bombs and the knives and stuff, wouldn't they do more digging or like try to find evidence so they could put the murders on him too? They just put him in jail for child molestation and that's enough.
But it's just like we talked, that was in the 60s. And it just seems like a lot just kind of...
went underneath, like, they just...
Yeah.
Well, we're not going to solve it. We haven't solved it yet. We're not going to solve it now. And how is the FBI, the CIA, all these other people with all access to all of this technology not decoding these letters? What are you getting paid for? You're supposed to protect us.
And it's crazy. It took those guys 15 years. And the one guy had been working on it for 15 years before those two joined.
So it honestly just kind of seems like, oh, if the CIA and the FBI and whoever else, they worked on it. And then they just kind of like, well, we haven't cracked it in 7 days.
Right.
You know, or I mean, 15 years.
And I mean, at this point, it's 2021. The guy's dead. But still, for the families, and
yeah.
I think the saddest thing about a lot of these, even the ones that are caught, like with Ted Bundy, they never found half of those bodies.
Right.
And he ended up admitting to way more people than they ever found.
And then with the Cleveland Torso Killer, like, he had victims that have never even been identified.
Right.
So their families just won't ever know what happened to them.
It's crazy how you can just make people disappear off the face of the earth like that. It's really sad.
Yeah.
But that is all I have for Zodiac. Very interesting case. I think the letters make it very unique.
Absolutely.
You know?
Because not every serial killer does letters in that way.
Right.
Or at all. To write ciphers like, you know how smart you have to be to do that?
Right.
Because, and Criminal Minds also touches on that, because there's a FBI agent who is extremely intelligent.
Yeah.
In the show, and they work on Spencer. They work on ciphers.
My baby.
All right. Thank you guys for hanging out with us just for a little bit today. We would love to hear your thoughts and theories on these cases. So DM us, comment on our Instagram post, co.signpodcast, or send us a voice message.
Especially with these unsolved cases, we've given you multiple possibilities.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have an opinion on who you think did it, hit us up.
Let us know.
Yeah.
Because we'd like to see how other people's brains work. We kind of know what we're thinking. We want to know what you're thinking.
Yeah.
And again, we are going to be doing a giveaway very, very soon. So make sure you follow us on Instagram, co.signpodcast, co.signpodcast.
All right. So like we always say,
every
single
Tuesday,
we'll be coming at you
next week.
Hey, we'll see you there.
Bye guys.
Oh my God. Oh my God. Oh my God. Oh my God. Oh my God.